Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Britons is in actual fact an entire dynasty of them, beginning with Brutus, the Trojan Prince. And of course my co-host for the show is Max Musson from Western Spring. The first king in the list is Brutus, and you know, we can't do Greatest Britons without doing the first king and who the country is actually named after. And we'll look at the evidence for him, and we'll also give a brief overview of the story of Brutus. I think we'll start with the overview of what we know about Brutus, and then we'll look at the evidence for him after that. I think that's probably the best way to do it, so that listeners get an idea of the narrative. The history itself begins with the Trojan Aeneas, who, according to Roman legend, settled in Italy after the Trojan War. And he's written about in the Odyssey, in the Iliad. I think it's pretty well accepted that Aeneas was a real person. He's referred to in lots of other places. And Brutus's father is Silvius, the son of Ascanius, the son of Aeneas, who was allowed to leave Troy. A magician who predicts great things for the unborn Brutus also foretells that he will kill both his parents. He does so in a freak hunting accident in the same manner described as in Nennius's Historia Britonum, and is banished. And that's the Nennius's history book that was written centuries before Geoffrey of Monmouth's one that also mentions Brutus. Travelling to Greece, he discovers a group of Trojans enslaved there. He becomes their leader, and after a series of battles, they defeat the Greek king Pandrasius by attacking his camp at night after capturing the guards. He takes Pandrasius hostage and forces him to let his people go. Brutus realizes there are not enough room for both peoples in Greece, and after taking Pandrasius' daughter Imogene in marriage, he is given ships and provisions for a voyage to find a new land, and he sets sail. The Trojans land on a deserted island and discover an abandoned temple to Diana. After performing the appropriate ritual, Brutus falls asleep in front of the goddess's statue and is given a vision of the land where he is destined to settle, a white island in the Western Ocean inhabited only by a few giants. And this is the translation from the Latin of what Diana supposedly said to him in his vision. Brutus, there lies beyond the Gallic bounds an island which the western sea surrounds. By giants once possessed, now few remain to bar thy entrance or obstruct thy reign. To reach that happy shore thy sails employ, their fate decrees to raise a second Troy, and found an empire in thy royal line, which time shall never destroy, nor bounds confine. And that last line there, they thought that was very prescient when they actually had the British Empire. They saw that as the fulfillment of this prophecy. And I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you're thinking this is 1,000 years ago, a long, long time before the British Empire, and you've got this prophecy that Britain will have an empire. There will be no bounds to actually confine Britain, and there will be an empire in thy royal line. So I think that that's something that bears thinking about. Even if that was just made up by Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's still 1,000 years ago. He had some notion that Britain was going to have a worldwide empire, basically.
Yeah.
After some adventures in North Africa, which shows that we had white people in North Africa, not African Negroes. And a close encounter with the Sirens, so there we have the mythical point, Brutus discovers another group of exiled Trojans living on the shores of the Tyrrhenian Sea, led by the prodigious warrior Corineus, who becomes his close friend. In Gaul, Corineus provokes a war with Gopherius Pictus, the king of Aquitaine, after hunting in the king's forests without permission. Brutus's nephew Chironus dies in the fighting, and the city of Tours is founded, where he is buried. And they say that the huge tumulus at Tours was actually created by Brutus, and that's where his nephew is buried in this huge tumulus, which the city is also named after. The Trojans win most of their battles, but are conscious that the Gauls have the advantage in number, so they go back to their ships and sail for Britain, which is then called Albion. They land on Totnesium Ilitus, the seacoast of Totnes, where they meet the giant descendants of Albion and defeat them. And there is an idea that what they're actually talking about here is the giant descendants. What they mean is the people that created the giant stone circles and the giant dolmens, and the people that he actually conquered were previous parts of his tribe anyway. They were Phoenicians, they were Trojans. The people that were in Britain already were the same ethnicity as him, but they were the builders of the stone circles and the dolmens. Because as we'll see in this next bit, Corineus has a fight with one of these giants, and he's actually able to pick him up and throw him, which says that he wasn't actually of giant stature. It must have been referring to something else. Well, Brutus renames the island after himself and becomes its first king. Corineus, his friend, becomes the ruler of Cornwall, which is named after him. They are harassed by the giants during a festival that kill all of them but their leader, the largest giant Gogmagog, or Gomagot, who is saved for a wrestling match against Corineus. Corineus then throws him over a cliff to his death at Plymouth. Brutus then founds a city on the banks of the River Thames, which he calls Troy Nova, or New Troy, and the name is in time corrupted to Trinovantium, and the city is later called London. He creates laws for his people based on the laws of Troy and rules for 24 years. After his death, he is buried in Trinovantium, and the island is divided between his three sons, Locrinus, who has England, Albernactus, who has Scotland, and Camber, who has Wales. And there is legend that that's where the names actually came from, but there is also another legend that he named his sons after the names of those different parts of Britain, basically. So Locrinus for England, Albernactus for Scotland, and Camber for Wales, saying that they already had these names, and that was the tribes that were there. And Brutus is basically made the king of the whole island. And that is the story of Brutus. Do you want to comment on that, Max, at all, the legend of Brutus?
Just to say that you mentioned a bit earlier on about there being white people living in Africa north of the Sahara, and of course the great opponents of the Roman Empire for much of its history were the Carthaginians, and the Carthaginians occupied the area which is now Tunisia primarily, and they were a white nation, and Hannibal, who marched with his elephants against Rome, was Carthaginian and was therefore white. I think, as far as the legend of Brutus is concerned, it when presented in the way that you have here, I think it has a high degree of credibility, particularly. I think that we're perhaps thinking here in some respects that Brutus would have been travelling with just with small numbers of men. But when we consider that where he was when he went to Greece, he rallied enough people to defeat the king there, or to defeat a king, he must have had thousands of soldiers following him, and so therefore him moving around would have been him transporting a large army, and so therefore in that he must have had a large army first of all to defeat a king of Greece, but then with a large army landing in the south of England at a time when their whole of the British Isles would have been covered by smaller tribes who didn't have large kingdoms at the time, then we can see that he could well have conquered large swathes of Britain in the way that this story suggests.
He had a fleet of ships. I mean, it was the Trojans that were all in subjection in one of these places that he ended up freeing. He ended up freeing four lots from one place, and one lot from when he went into Greece. And where we get this word, the Tyrrhenian Sea, which is around by Italy, that's actually named after Tyre, which is Phoenicia, which is today called Syria. And that shows us that the Phoenicians were all the way up in Italy. And apparently they were in Britain as well. And they would have known his pedigree, that he was a Trojan prince. He was from, his father was Silvius. It's another famous person. And the Romans themselves were also descended from this same family. Romulus, from the legend of Romulus and Remus, was also descended from this same family. So they were all linked in together. They were all the same ethnicity. And at this time, we had castes as well. Don't forget, we had a noble caste and we had a working caste. And you know, you paid your respects to somebody once you knew that they were from this noble caste. And
this is a little different, really, from the situation that existed at the beginning of the 20th century, where we had kings and queens and the nobility of Germany and of Russia and of Britain and several other European countries as well, all being first cousins and all being interrelated.
Yeah, because you know, blue blood had to marry blue blood. If you were royalty, then you had to marry other royalty. I think Aeneas married the daughter of someone called Latium, and that started up the Latins. And then you got Romulus, who would have been one of Brutus's cousins. So you can see that you've got the same sort of families that are, according to myth, started off these empires. And that ties us into the Romans. And it shows that we were the same ethnicity as the Romans. So, of course, when the Romans came into Britain, that's why we don't really find any change to our DNA. We don't find any change at all to the genetics, because it was essentially it was the same people coming into Britain that were already here. The legend of Albion, where that got its name from as well, that was supposedly from a Phoenician king who had, I think it was 40 daughters, something like that. And one of the daughters he married to a prince, and the prince was a really good prince, and she refused to do what the prince told her to do. And the prince came back to the king and said, look, this wife you've given me, she's been very badly behaved. And the king said to his daughter, you must obey your husband. And she said, okay, I'll obey my husband. And she went and said to her 40 sisters, let's all murder our husbands tonight. And they did. They murdered the husband. So they were all put on a ship and they were cast adrift. And the ship, I mean, this is all legend. This is all myth, basically. And the ship itself then landed in England. And the princess's name was Albion. So the name, England was actually given this name Albion after this feminist, basically. But there was nobody on the island. So they ended up interbreeding with devils and producing giants, which is supposedly the explanation for who these giants were that Brutus slaughtered. So you can see from that, all of that is supernatural. All of that is myth, but it does contain a little bit of truth in that the original settlers of Britain were from Phoenicia, from this Phoenician king. I think he was called Dungi or something like that. And he is talked about elsewhere. Again, there's more research that I need to do on this. There's a guy called Alan Wilson who is an absolute expert on this, and he wrote a book, I think, called The Trojan Empire, something like that. And I'm hoping that eventually I will be able to get hold of that. He's an alternative historian that I have a lot of respect for. So I don't know that much about the origins of this Dungi, but apparently he's done a lot of research into it. And this is where we get the name Surrey from, which comes from Syria. And we've got Bridport, which comes from Brutus Port, which is in Dorset. And we'll probably see next week as well, when we get into the proofs of this, that there are quite a lot of places that are actually named after Brutus like Cornwall, named after Corineus. And that's the tale of where Cornwall got its name from. But we'll get into all that next week. Max, do you want to add anything else to that before we finish today?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is a good point for us to pause.
Shall we get into Greatest Legendary Britons?
Let's get into Greatest Legendary Britons, yes.
Okay, well, let's get into some of the evidence of Brutus. We talked about Brutus last week, the first known king of Britain, and we talked about Brutus's life story and how he was a Trojan, how he met up with other Trojans, freed them, had a vision that he was going to found a kingly line that would then found an empire which would have no bounds, which eventually became the British Empire. And of course, this vision was it was written down 1,000 years before we actually had the British Empire, and how he came to Britain, and there were giants in Britain, and he had his friend Corineus, and he threw one of the giants off the cliff, and the giant's name was Gogmagot, and his friend's name was Corineus, and that's where we get the name Cornwall from. I'm just sort of summarizing all of this here, and today we'll start by having a look at some of the proofs for this. And we have to remember that the first written evidence I think we have of Brutus is from about 500 AD from Gildas, and then we have Nennius, and then Geoffrey of Monmouth claimed that he got his information from a text that was handed to him that was written in an old Brittonic tongue which dealt with all of this, and that was in the 12th century. So all that time, right up until the 16th or the 17th century, it was accepted that this was the origin of the Britons, was in this King Brutus. And it's only been in the last 200 or 300 years that people have started to doubt this. And I think there's enough evidence to show that this is pretty much what actually happened. And the first proof is that we have Gogmagog's Leap, which is actually at Plymouth. And it looks like the hoe in Plymouth Hoe was the hoe from Corineus heaving this giant off his shoulders and into the sea. And that's why it's actually called Gogmagog's Leap. And that also shows us that these giants that were displaced by Brutus, they weren't actual physical giants, but what they were responsible for is for building the megaliths, building the dolmens, putting up the standing stones. So this is why they had the name of giants, because they put up these giant structures. So that's one proof that we have for it, is this name. And as we know,
and they may just have been people who would, by today's standards, and perhaps the standards of other places in the world in those days, have been regarded as being exceptionally tall. In that, if you go back to Upper Paleolithic times, the Cro-Magnon peoples tended to be much taller than people are today. On average, they tended to be like 6 foot tall, and so it could well be that prior to the birth of the British tribes, that there were still a disproportionately large number of people of Cro-Magnon descent, and who would have appeared larger than the average, and so therefore perhaps described as giants.
Yeah, they could have been of tall stature, taller than they were used to, taller than the Britons were used to. We also have the Totnes Brutus Stone, which is in the town of Totnes. That's apparently where Brutus came ashore, and he put his foot on this stone. That's still there to this day. I don't know how old that is. It's actually in the town itself. It's known as the Brutus Stone. And the fact that we have these stones and these places that are named after these people, that says these people really existed. Why else would you have a place that was named after them? You know, and the names last for years. They last for centuries. We've got places out there in the Middle East that were named after people from thousands of years ago that still have the same name to this day. We also have the London Stone, and the London Stone is said to be the heelstone of the temple that Brutus built. And there has been people that have questioned that have said that this link with Brutus only came about in the last 1,000 years. But again, it's a stone that was linked to him, and that was apparently put there by Brutus. And whether you believe that or not, it's still named after him. We also have the rivers and the names of towns. We have places like Bridport, which is Brutus Port. We have the River Thames, which is apparently named after a river in Epirus, which is where we were saying last week. Epirus in Greece is where he picked up with all these other Trojans. In fact, we have lots of places that are in Britain that are named after places in Greece, places in Phoenicia, and places in Troy. Marazion in Cornwall, apparently that's named after one of these places. L.A. Waddell in particular has done a lot of research into this, and I've got a quote from him here. Certain it is, I find, that the majority of the chief river names from Totnes to the Thames, including the latter river name itself, are clearly transplanted namesakes from the rivers of Epirus, whence Brutus sailed, and the rivers of Troy and Phoenicia. These were presumably bestowed thereupon by Brutus or his early descendants, just as a similar series of names has been applied to the Cornwall coast to the west of Totnes, and just as modern British colonists transplant the cherished names of their old homeland to their new colonies. And of course, we have New South Wales, New York,
New England.
Yeah, Newfoundland. lots of places that are named after the original cities and towns that we have in Britain. We also have a character called Peritus, which is basically Brutus. It's P-R-T-H-O-O-S. And P can be changed for a B, basically, in old alphabets. So Brutus sounds very similar to Brutus in Homer's Iliad and Homer's Odyssey. And this guy, Peritus, Homer has him in Epirus in Greece, where he's marriage hunting, which is exactly what Brutus did. And he has him as the grandson of Ascanius, Ascanius, I think, was Brutus's father. And in the Iliad and the Odyssey, Peritus's best friend is called Coronus, which is Coronius, which is essentially the same name as Brutus's best friend Coronius, who had this fight with Gogmagog the giant. And Peritus suddenly disappears from ancient classic Greek history, and they don't know what happened to him. So I would suggest that's Brutus in elsewhere in history, because modern researchers today will say, well, there's no evidence of Brutus in any of these Greek histories. Well, that's because he was called Peritus. It was a very similar name, and that's why this Peritus disappears from these histories. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
No, I would think that was an argument that you took from Lawrence Waddell, I would think, because having read his book, The Makers of Civilization, he uses that kind of linguistic and phonetic, that sort of phonetics to project how names developed, where names were passed down by word of mouth rather than having been written.
Yes, that's from The Phoenician Origin of Britons, Scots and Anglo-Saxons by L.A. Waddell. He did lots of really good work into languages and philology and phonetics. I think that comes from the word Phoenician as well. It certainly has the same P-H-O-E-N at the beginning of it. We have Edward the Confessor, who wrote London, a city founded and built after the likeness of great Troy. Now, I think Edward the Confessor is about the 11th or the 12th century, just going offhand. Do you know Edward the Confessor, what year he was, Max?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't off the top of my head either. I think it was shortly after William the Conqueror. I know he was a Norman king, I think. I don't think it was a Saxon king. And the foundation myth of Brutus having settled in Britain was still considered as genuine history during the early modern period. For example, in Holinshed's Chronicles, 1577, they consider the Brutus myth to be factual. And I would say it has mythic components to it, but there is all this evidence that that it was factual. I'm sure there is other evidence. There's a book written all about this by Alan Wilson, which I haven't actually had a chance to read myself yet. He certainly believes the story to be true. So that's the evidence that I was able to find for this. Do you want to add anything else to the evidence before we continue with the narrative here, Max?
Well, just a word that I was struggling for a little bit was extrapolate. This the Waddell, one of his techniques is to extrapolate with certain words, and he shows the common origin of lots of words, which therefore demonstrates common ancestry of the people involved who either had those names or used those names. And one of the extrapolations that just sort of sticks in my mind is that if you look at kings, the various empires, etc., that existed in the Tigris and the Euphrates Valley there were very often referred to, and in India, in the Indus Valley, are referred to as Shah. Shah is an Indian word meaning king, but Shah is very similar to the Russian word meaning king, which is Tsar, which is C-Z-A-R, and C-Z-A-R then becomes very similar to Caesar, which was used by the Romans, and Caesar then is very similar to Kaiser, which is used as king in German. So that is the kind of linguistic extrapolation that Waddell uses in order to show the common origins of language. And in his case, because he was an exponent of the Aryan origin of the languages of Europe, this all ties in with that line of thinking as well.
Yes, this is one of the ways that we can tell that these people were all white, because they had these similar languages that can be shown to go back to an original Indo-Aryan language, an original Indo-European language. And L.A. Waddell does do some fantastic work into that. I did an episode on L.A. Waddell while you weren't here, Max, that listeners might want to go and check out to find out more information about him. To get back to the story of Brutus here, after Brutus's death, the island was divided between his three sons, Locrinus in England, Albanactus in Scotland, and Camber in Wales. And Humber, the king of the Huns, then invaded and took over what is now Scotland, killing Albanactus and driving his people south. Locrinus then kills Humber by drowning him in the River Humber, which was then given his name. And as I say, it's because these places are named after these people, that gives credence to these stories about them, I believe. And this happened around about the 12th century BC, and we still have Ulster Scots and Protestants being called Huns in honour of this to this day by the Gaelic people, by Irish people. They still call them Huns, because that's apparently where they came from. And again, this shows us that the Huns were originally white. They weren't Asiatic. They were white. And also just some interesting information around about this time, the 12th century BC, in case people think, well, the British people, they were savages at this time. I've got a couple of instances of evidence of Iron Age civilization here. Skara Brae in the Orkneys was occupied from roughly 3180 BC to about 2500 BC. And is Europe's most complete Neolithic village. And I don't know if listeners have seen it. It's well worth looking it up. It's a proper stone housing complex that you've got there that's made out of stone, with a hearth and a kitchen and all the rest of it. And also, just last week, they discovered the foundations of a 5,700-year-old Neolithic house. That's 3,700 BC. Evidence of Bronze Age burials and Iron Age smelting. And this was all discovered by archaeologists as a result of excavations at the sites of two road realignment projects in County Cork, Ireland. So we don't just have evidence of housing, we have evidence of smelting. And the fact they found the evidence of smelting there is quite interesting, because they say that that shows that there were roads there, because the smelting would have been there by the side of the road to make use of travellers that were travelling along the road. So that sort of tends to say that we had roads all the way back in 3700 BC in Ireland. So when you're talking about this time, which is 1200 BC, They would have been quite civilized people, I would have thought. Not savages like they try and tell us today, incapable of putting one brick on top of the other, because we have the evidence here of these stone houses. Do you want to respond to those comments about Skara Brae at all?
Well, we'll do. And just to say that as far as Bronze Age edifices and Bronze Age buildings are concerned here in the UK, quite close to the Northern Irish, Southern Irish border. I think it's just about 20 miles south of the Southern Irish border, right on the eastern side of Ireland. There is a place called New Grange, where there is a a building there, which is basically a temple to the sun, which has been built so that, and I'm not quite sure whether it's Midsummer's Day or whether it's Midwinter's Day, but there's one day of the year where the sun shines down through a slit that's been cut in one of the doors or one of the doorways. And this shaft of light goes all the way down a corridor to a room at the end where there was an altar. So I think it probably is twice a year the sun shines down and actually shines on this altar, which then basically shows that the people that were there were worshipping the sun and that they had created this this temple. Most people are very familiar with Stonehenge and the fact that Stonehenge was constructed by people who were sun worshippers. And that's why certain of the stones are positioned in particular places, so that at Midsummer's Day the shadow of one stone falls upon another stone, and so Stonehenge can be used in order to create a calendar so that they can calculate the passage of the years, etc., and the passage of time. But then also quite close to Stonehenge is Avebury, where there's another stone circle, and Silbury Hill, which is the highest man-made object, I think, in Europe prior to during the Iron Age. Silbury Hill is a man-made hill that's made entirely of chalk. It's been estimated that it would have taken 500 men 50 years to shift the chalk in order to create the hill. So obviously a tremendous amount of effort was invested in that. And then just south of Silbury Hill, there is the West Kennet Long Barrow, where there are a number of burial chambers that obviously important people in those days would have been buried in. So in keeping what you were saying, the people of Britain in those times were far more advanced than often they're given credit for.
They must have been very, very technologically advanced to understand astronomy and to understand where the positions of the sun and where it was going to be, and to have that measured out on a plan before building this, particularly with Newgrange. I mean, at Stonehenge, you've got it where it hits the heel stone and comes in through a big gap. But when you're talking about Newgrange, you're talking about a tiny little gap there that the sun comes in through. And it may be that they have it on summer solstice and the winter solstice. Because I know at Stonehenge they do. They celebrate on the summer solstice and the winter solstice. Because at both times it's at one time it's the longest day, and the other time it's the shortest day. But they were certainly well advanced peoples back then. They were the same type of peoples as we are today. I don't think we've changed that much over the years. We may have changed a little bit physically, just with breeding priorities, but as far as actual IQ level, I think we were pretty much the same back then as we are now. I think the evidence that there is for civilization, when we see this evidence for civilization, that is also evidence for the white man being there, because those stone structures, the stone circles, the standing stones, the dolmens, we find them all over the world. In actual fact, quite a surprising fact is that almost half of them are found in North Korea. And they were actually built much later than the ones in Europe, which tends to say that we got there later than we did into Europe and into India and the Middle East. And one of the last places we actually got to was in North Korea. And then in China, in the Taklamakan Desert there, we find bodies of Aryans going back to about 3,500 BC or about 3,000 BC, sorry. And we don't actually find the skeletons of the Mongoloid types until about 1500 BC. So you can see that the people that today that we now know as the Chinese, they didn't even get there until after the Aryans. So I'm a firm believer that civilization, all the civilizations were actually started off by Aryans, white people, whether obviously they're not still there now because they fell to race mixing. And we didn't have non-whites in Britain. These were white people that Brutus came across, because they accepted him as king as well. It wasn't that he genocided all these people, but they accepted him as king. So they must have been in connection with Phoenicia through the through the mining that they had there, because there was the tin mining and everything else that they would then sell to these Phoenician traders, who would then take their wares to the Near East and even as far as India. And I think the first colonists into Britain would have been these Phoenician colonists, these miners. So they would have been aware of Troy. They would have been aware of who Brutus was, and they accepted him as his king. Well, the story then progresses rapidly through the reigns of the descendants of Locrinus up to a character called Bladud, who is our next king of note. And his son was the famous King Lear that Shakespeare wrote a play about. Wikipedia tells us there is no evidence to support Bladud's existence. But if there is evidence for his son Lear, then Lear must have had a father. And we are told that he was contemporaneous with the biblical prophet Elijah, 9th century BC. And I had a look because I thought maybe there might have been some coins, some numismatic evidence for King Lear, but I couldn't actually find any. But there is evidence of places being named after Bladud. Bladud was sent by his father to be educated in the liberal arts in Athens, and after his father's death, he returned with four philosophers and founded a university at Stamford in Lincolnshire, which flourished until it was suppressed by St. Augustine of Canterbury on account of heresies which were taught there. So that would have been in 597 AD. And the heresy that was taught there was probably the early Celtic Christianity, which St. Augustine had an issue with, because Britain had been Christian since about 150 AD. It was a different type of Christianity to the type that St. Augustine brought. But the fact that he founded a university there, and it was mentioned that St. Augustine suppressed it in 597 AD, that says to me that Bladud was a real king. And we have some more evidence here as well. He ruled for 20 years from either 863 BC or 500 BC, in which time he built Carbadum or Carvadum, the city of Bath. He is said to have founded the city because while he was in Athens, he contracted leprosy, and when he returned home, he was imprisoned as a result. But he escaped, went off to go into hiding. He found employment as a swineherd at Swineswick, which is about 2 miles from the latest site of Bath, and he noticed that his pigs would go into an alder moor in cold weather and return covered in black mud. He found that this mud was warm, and that the pigs did it in order to enjoy the heat. And he also noticed that the pigs which did this did not suffer from skin diseases like the others did, and on trying the mud bath for himself, found that he was cured of his leprosy. He was then restored to his position as heir apparent to his father, and founded Bath so that others might also benefit as he had done. He dedicated the city to the goddess Athena, who is also known as Minerva, and in honour of her he lit undying fires, whose flames turned to balls of stone as they grew low, with new ones springing up in their stead. And this seems to be an embellishment of an account from the 4th century writer Solinus of the use of local coal on the altars of her temple. So it seems to me what they're referring here is to there was a custom of burning coals, which were basically like balls of stone. So I think that's what was being referred to here, that they had discovered that they could burn coal. But the main thing that he's famous for is flying. He also encouraged the practice of necromancy or divination through the spirits of the dead. And through this practice, he is said to have constructed wings for himself and to have tried to fly from the Temple of Apollo in Trinovantium in London, or Troy Nova, New Troy. But he was killed when he hit a wall and broke his neck. And that Brutus stone that I was talking about earlier, that was supposedly part of this temple in London that Brutus built, and that was the temple that he tried to fly from and broke his neck. And the 18th century Bath architect John Wood the Elder wrote about Bladud and put forth the suggestion that he should be identified with Abaris the Hyperborean, the healer known from classical Greek sources. And I've read elsewhere that Abaris the Hyperborean was actually from Britain, so it could be that it was the same character here. And we have a statue of King Bladud overlooking the King's Bath at Bath, which carries the date of 1699, but its inclusion in earlier pictures shows that it is much older than this. So I think there is some evidence for Bladud being in existence, and he is one of the kings that I've heard mentioned in Parliament. I've heard Jacob Rees-Mogg. bring up the fact that Bladud was the founder of Bath. So it was actually put into the minutes of government that Bladud was the founder of the King of Bath, because Jacob Rees-Mogg actually brought it up. Do you want to make any comments on the, on this legendary king? I mean, he's not really one of our greatest kings, but he was obviously looked at years ago as a great British personage who founded the city of Bath and discovered that the springs there had healing properties. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Well, I just find it a very sort of interesting story, actually. Obviously, there is a certain amount of evidence for these stories, as you've outlined. But I would say that for the vast majority of people, myself included, these stories are very new and make an interesting addition to our understanding of the ancient past for our nation. And it creates some interesting stories that you can, I can just imagine telling some of these stories to young children and the children finding them quite amusing and quite finding them interesting, you know, particularly the sort of Bladud trying to fly and things of that sort. And so I would say I'm just enjoying listening to you recounting these stories.
Well, it could help to give children a sense of identity. And you think, you know, we were talking 1,500 years ago, and these are the sort of stories that the bards would talk about, and people would know their history from this. We've got one last king in Brutus's line, because this is all through the line of Brutus, and that is King Lear. He's not a greatest Briton, again, and he is legendary, but the story of his life, I think, contains good moral instruction. Lear actually had three daughters and no sons, so he was the end of the line for Brutus, basically. And as he neared death, he divided his kingdom among the three daughters. Goneril and Regan flattered their father, and at the advice of Lear's nobles, were married off to the Dukes of Albany and Cornwall, respectively. Cordelia, the third one, despite being her father's favourite, refused to flatter the king, feeling that he should not need to make special assurances of her love, and she was given no land to rule because of it. King Aganippus of the Franks courted and married Cordelia, despite Lear's refusal to pay a dowry to him. Lear then gave Goneril and Regan half his kingdom, planning to bequeath to them the remainder at his death. But instead, his sons-in-law rebelled and seized the whole kingdom. King Maglorus of Albany, Goneril's husband, maintained Lear with a retinue of 60 knights. But his wife then reduced this by half after 2 years. So Lear then fled to Regan, who reduced his entourage to only 5 men. Returning to Albany and pleading with Goneril, Lear was left with just one single knight for protection. So his daughters completely stitched him up and took him for everything that he had. And at this point, Lear feared both his older daughters, thought they might kill him, and he fled to France and sent Cordelia a messenger when he was outside her court at Caritia. She had him bathed, royally clothed, and assigned a fittingly large band of retainers. He was then officially received by the king and made the regent of France, with the Frankish nobles vowing to restore him to his former glory. Lear, Cordelia, and her husband invaded Britain and successfully overthrew his other daughters and sons-in-law, and Lear ruled another 3 years and then died. Cordelia succeeded him and buried him in an underground shrine to the god Janus beneath the river Soar near Leicester, which was named after him, and allegedly the current site of the city's Jewry Wall. An annual feast was held nearby in his honour. Apparently Leicester is named after King Lear. That's the only real sort of evidence that we have for him, and the play of Shakespeare. And I found this particularly interesting, this Jewry Wall, because I'd never heard of anything called a Jewry Wall before. And apparently it's not named after the Jews, and it's much older than the time Simon de Montfort expelled the Jews from Leicester, which was in 1231. He expelled them for practicing usury against the Christians. And the Jewry Wall is actually made of 2nd century Roman masonry. And there are other Jewry Walls that are named as Jewry Walls throughout the country. And it is spelt J-E-W-R-Y. And Wikipedia says that it is possibly named after jurors, part of a jury, but I'm not so sure. And I was just wondering if listeners had heard of these jury walls before and if they had any ideas on what they actually were. And you were telling me before we went on Air Max that you hadn't heard of it before, but what do you make of this story of King Lear? I think it has a good moral to it.
Yes. It does remind me of other stories that I can't quite sort of put my finger on at the moment, but it makes you realise, I suppose, when you hear these stories that there was probably a fair amount of politicking going on, and certainly even when we look at later times with King Alfred, etc., and the wars that he had against the Vikings. And the way in which the wars that he had went from times where he was victorious to times where he was almost defeated, etc., and the tide of battle swung backwards and forwards, that in earlier times, in the time of King Lear, that the same kind of contests were taking place and the same kind of rivalries amongst noble people existed as well. And were the prompts for these wars and struggles.
And I think it also shows that we were connected up with the continent. We knew what was going on in Greece. We had cordial relations with the Franks, who helped him to get his kingdom back. And, you know, people say, well, you got these Christian stories and Christian stories are from the Near East. And then we got people that say, well, we should be looking at Nordic pagan myths and they all come from Scandinavia. And then we've got our own stories here. We've got our own myths and legendary figures that our bards used to sing about in our own songs. And it's just a great shame that more British nationalists aren't interested in this stuff and don't learn this stuff, because this is our heritage. This is our history. And when you learn about this sort of stuff, you can imagine your ancestors doing the same. Like you were saying, just then, Max, about children finding these stories interesting. You know, the children would have been fascinated by this, and they would have grown up knowing these stories and being able to repeat them to one another. And they would have played at being bladdered when they were outside, or played at being King Lear, you know, rather than kids today. Or I don't know, even if they do still go out and play Star Wars or play war amongst one another. But these are the stories that our ancestors would have been brought up on. And I think it's beneficial to learn them again now, particularly if you're a nationalist and you're interested in nationalism. I think all nationalists should understand where we come from, know some of our heroes. And too many people idolize the Scandinavian stuff, I find, especially if they're interested in pagan stuff. Well, look at the British pagan stuff. Look at the Druids. Look at this stuff where they were worshipping the Greek gods, because that's our history. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more about our greatest Britons, then tune in to Real Britannia, which we produce here at Radio Albion every Monday, where it features in the second half of that show. Or you can wait until we edit the separate episodes together and put them into one show like the one you have just heard.